Thanks again, it's wonderful. Thank you. Happy Hanukkah to all of us. Thank you. Thanks very much. About 2 weeks ago, thanks to Time magazine, I learned that I am among the happiest people in the land. The happiest at my job, anyway. I'm not kidding. The magazine did a survey of people who were the happiest and the least happy with their jobs. Whatever their criteria for happiness was, they didn't actually say what it was. Members of the clergy of a wide range of faith traditions came in first. Firefighters came in second. Ministers and firefighters, and then on down from there to gas station attendants who were the least happy with their jobs. I only report this stuff, don't ask me to explain it. Although I'll try to explain the minister part in just a minute. Now, I gotta tell you though, I tried mightily to come up with some kind of cute and clever reason as to why ministers and firefighters got grouped together as numbers 1 and 2 at the top of the happiness scale, and I couldn't come up with anything at all. So if you can come up with kind of a punchline to that, you know, let me know, and maybe I can use it somewhere else. Well, that timepiece did generate a certain amount of chatter on a UU minister's chat line that I'm on, with a bunch of us emailing back and forth trying to figure out if we're as happy as we're supposed to be. And I was reading through all this. It was the day before Thanksgiving, and I was in kind of a whimsical sort of mood. I was sitting around by myself in an empty house. Michelle and Gordon had left for New York the day before, and I was going to join them. I did join them the next day. So I dashed off a few thoughts of my own on the subject to this chat line using the title, "If You're Happy and You Know It." I clicked send and didn't think much more about it until that evening. Later that evening and the next day, I started getting requests from several of my colleagues asking if they could quote me on what I'd said in some of their sermons, which sent me back to reread just what it was I didn't say. And then when I came to write this sermon, I figured that as some of my esteemed colleagues out there are using my stuff, I might as well get some mileage out of it myself. So with some minor editing, here is part of what I said. Throwing in the usual caveats about happiness being hard to define and knowing that we've all had our less than happy times, I can buy into what Time is reporting. I certainly don't go around deliriously happy all the time, as that would be a little hard to take. It would make me very hard to take as well. But with over 35 years in the ministry and with still a few trips around the block left yet to come, I don't know of anything else I could have done with my life to this point that's given me a better overall sense of satisfaction than being a minister has. Here's why I think clergy came out at or near the top of the happiness scale. First, ours is one of the few callings and professions left, especially when it comes to the Unitarian Universalist ministry, where you can be an actual Renaissance person and still make a living at it. I don't know of any career I could have chosen that allows me to draw on as wide a range of interests and involvements as I have, and still feel that they are a part of a larger whole. Or to put it another way, being a minister has allowed me to live a largely unfragmented life, even with the various fragmented times and fragmented moments that every one of us experiences now and then. And second, ministry is not an end in itself, or only a way to make a living. It is that. Granted, there are times, as we all know, when it feels just like a job, and a pain in the wherever job at that, but ministry is really about serving a higher cause or purpose, named in a variety of ways that transcends even the word ministry. I know there are other professions that can rightfully make that same claim, but I think it is especially pronounced with us. I think a fundamental concept of happiness or state of well-being is living with a sense and an awareness that you are participating in something greater than yourself. And ministry gives us that. Well, then I figured I'd better wrap this up on a little more down-to-earth note, and so I added this. I'm going to save what I've just written here so I can refer to it when I'm in one of my, what on earth was I thinking about when I chose to do this kinds of moods? But it's the day before Thanksgiving, and I'm in that quiet lull before the holiday storm, and thinking that all in all, I rather like where I am and what I'm doing. And on that note, I signed off. So yeah, I kind of looked back on that, and I thought, yeah, I would say that, and this goes for every one of us, certainly far beyond the profession, career, and calling I happen to be in, but I think that living with some sense of wholeness to your life, granted, as I say, you're going to have times when you're going to feel a lot of fragmentation, and living with some sense that you're serving some greater cause, purpose, that you're part of some larger thing, some larger whole, some larger meaning, even if you can't fully name it. I think those two things are essential components for knowing happiness and joy. Because as I mused a bit on this conversation with my colleagues and these happiness rankings in Time magazine, I decided what we were really talking about and writing about was joy. And I don't mean to split semantic hairs here, but I think it's possible to live a life of joy without always being happy or always having fun. In fact, one of my former colleagues in UU ministry, who has now passed away, expressed this idea very well in a meditation piece he wrote about joy and fun. I think he wrote it for the holiday season. I found it in a collection of writings of his that have long since been out of print. His name was Reverend John Taylor. Here's part of what he said on the theme of joy and fun. It is not difficult to bring fun into our lives, but it is a lifelong task to find joy. Fun arrives, contributes its brief sensation, and leaves. Fun is escape, which we all need. Joy is fulfillment, which we all seek. Well, just for the record, I am in favor of, and I seek out, both joy and fun. Now, fun, for me, one example of fun for me is, you know, sitting around with a few friends and a few brews and a nice spread of food and watching the Patriots thrash their latest opponent. Now that's fun. It's the kind of fun that I can get into, that I need to get into. It's the kind of escape we all need, as Reverend Taylor puts it. But joy, really, is more of an ongoing quest. It's a quest, in Taylor's words, again, for the fulfillment we all seek. On the Christian calendar, this is the first Sunday of the four Sundays of Advent. And the four themes of these Sundays are joy, hope, peace, and love. For Christians, they are the four things to be meditated upon, thought about, tried to bring into your life, in order to prepare you to celebrate the arrival or the advent of the birth of Jesus. And I would also say that beyond any particular religious observance, that these are four basic elements that one needs to possess internally in order, I think, to have any kind of spiritual life, whatever one's faith stance may be. And so with that in mind, I'm going to explore just a little bit further this theme or element of joy. To John Taylor's wise words that I've already offered, I would add these from the 18th century British romantic poet, William Blake. Joy and woe are woven fine, clothing for the soul divine. Under every grief and pain, under every grief and pine runs a joy with silken twine. Well, Blake's language may be a little archaic, especially if you're not into 18th century British romantic poets, but his words are very wise. For what Blake and Taylor are each saying in their own way is that joy is something that is meaningfully arrived at sometimes in the midst of the tests and the challenges and even the pains that life invariably places upon and visits upon us. So what I'd like to do for the next several minutes is to offer just a couple of perspectives, which, while not guaranteeing joy, in the sense that I have described it. I'm hoping they can keep us open to it, hoping they can keep us alive to the possibility that the fulfillment we all seek can, on occasion, be found and realized. Well, one perspective is to maintain an awareness that we live in the midst of the choices that we have made and the ones that have been made for us, learning to live in that kind of tension. In working with Rick Maston on the book I introduced last week, and which is on sale in the coffee hour today, one of his poems that really stood out for me, and the one that he specifically requested that I end the book with, was called Master of Ceremonies. I'm going to take you through it. A little unusual, pairing Rick Blake with Rick Maston with William Blake, but we'll see how it works. Anyway, this is Rick's Master of Ceremonies. I refuse to believe in personal free choice. I feel like I have it, but when I back away from something I have chosen, it always turns out that the choice I made was based on something I didn't choose. I arrive predetermined. Gifts and talents, DNA, IQ, disposition, all of which begat the artist, that begat the actor-player, that begat the troubadour, that begat the poet, that begat the minister, adding up to the master of ceremonies that I am now. Rick is expressing in a poetic way what the theologian Paul Tillich called finite freedom. Tillich said that we are creatures of finite freedom, meaning we make our choices within the boundaries that life gives us, to which Rick alludes in his poem. We make our choices within the boundaries life gives us, including the ultimate boundary of our mortality. Back to the poem. I ask myself, how lucky can you be? Able to make a good livelihood by assisting the creation of unforgettable moments for audience and congregation, but most of all for the couples I have danced with on the beaches and rocky promontories. Those last couple of lines refer to the wedding Rick officiates in the Big Sur, California area where he lives. And what he's really celebrating in the poem is the life he's been able to find for himself and create for himself within the time-bound existence he's been given to live it, and with all the givens that he got on the front end on the moment that he was born. And so he closes his poem with these words. For someone who doesn't believe that my choices are free, I rejoice in the life that has chosen me. As I said, this was the note that Rick asked to end the book on, so those are the last lines in the book. He said, could we end it on this note? I was more than willing to oblige. And he wrote this poem sometime after being diagnosed with terminal prostate cancer, which he continues to battle. And that battle, as those of you who are on his weekly email list know, has certainly had its less than joyful moments, especially in recent weeks, although he seems to have come back quite remarkably from his latest round of chemotherapy treatments. So joy and woe are indeed woven fine. But to be able to look at the givens of our lives and the finite freedom choices that we make in the face of those givens, and then be able to say, as Rick does, I rejoice in the life that has chosen me, is to know joy. Another condition or perspective for keeping joy available and attainable, I believe, is to have a sense of peace with one's personal past, with all that you chose and didn't choose, but got anyway. In his book, The Wind in Both Ears, the Universalist minister, one-time dean at St. Lawrence College, the late Dr. Angus MacLean wrote, I believe that in order to be truly free, one must make peace with his or her personal past. This is a freedom made up of some appreciation, some forgiveness, and some understanding. That's good. Appreciation, understanding, and forgiveness. What is it that you can look back upon in your life to this point and say that you value, that you appreciate, that you can say yes to? I'm sure there's lots of things there. And there are, no doubt, things that got visited upon you that you cannot value, that you cannot appreciate. But can you try to come to understand how they happened? But understanding can only go so far as well in certain cases, in certain instances. And when appreciation and understanding are difficult, if not impossible, then is it possible for forgiveness of others or even yourself to come into play? The freedom of which Dr. McLean writes and speaks here is not the freedom of forgetting or the freedom of dismissing, which isn't really freedom at all, but rather it is the freedom of reconciliation, of being reconciled to oneself and to all that has brought you here, the life that chose you as well as the life you chose, the joys, the pains, and all that's in between. This is a season when remembrances are especially pronounced. And some of them, many of them, I hope, bring us joy. And others remind us sometimes of the unhealed parts of ourselves, the unhealed parts of our world. This is a season that reminds us of our need to be at peace with our personal selves. For having this kind of peace, however much of a struggle it may be at times, is another condition that keeps joy available for us. And my final perspective this morning for keeping joy available is being able to believe in your eternal spring. Those two words are from a line by Albert Camus that is a part of my personal scripture and ones I know I've referred to before from this pulpit. Camus once wrote, "In the midst of winter, I discovered that there was within me an eternal spring." Camus was an avowed atheist. But if religion can be defined as having a passion for life, which is one of my many definitions of the term, then he was one of the more religious atheists I've ever encountered in his works. I find the phrase eternal spring to be a wonderful metaphor for that which ultimately sustains and nurtures each of us. And I'm also struck by Camus saying that he found his eternal spring in the midst of winter, rather say than in the pleasantries of summer. The promise of life is found, he is saying, sometimes in the midst of death and diminishment. And his words resonate well with those of John Taylor's, "Joy is a product of time and sacrifice. It is pride from the great stones of existence." But Taylor also adds in that piece that joy occasionally surprises us in the midst of effort. The surprise of joy in the midst of effort, the eternal spring in the midst of winter. For me, these are the eternal messages of this season. They are the eternal messages that are behind all of the stories, the myths, the metaphors, the symbols of this season. Light fades and fires are lit. The cold comes and fires of warmth are kindled. The earth dies and a birth is celebrated in the midst of winter. And the eternal spring is found. This is what we are promised. The challenge is to believe and act upon such promises, for that and only that is what makes them real, since in the end they are promises we have to make to ourselves and to each other. And the challenge to us is to be a sustaining community. For joy is found in the midst of effort and even woe, and where it can surprise us as well, and where we will offer to one another a rose in the wintertime. The words are in our closing hymn, number 346. Let's sing that together.